On June the 27th, 2005, a church-going, scout-leading father of two enters a Wichita courtroom. He's unassuming, dressed in a tan suit and dark green patterned tie. His hairline receded and his glasses pushed high on the bridge of his nose. He walks up to the judge calmly, showing no signs of agitation or distress, and gets ready to answer for crimes that he committed 30 years prior. What would follow over the next 45 minutes would shock the court and the world watching at home. Hey listeners, just a really quick content note. Obviously, this is a true crime podcast, and whilst I do try and avoid the absolutely grisly details of crimes, this isn't something that I really like to cover on here. There are descriptions in this episode that pertain to children. If that is something you are particularly sensitive to, then you might want to heed the warning and look after yourself. Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Rader, I need to find out more information. On that particular day, the 15th day of January, 1974, can you tell me where you went to kill Mr. Joseph Otero?
I think it's 1834, Edgemore.
All right. Can you tell me approximately what time of day you went there?
Somewhere between 7 and 7:30.
This particular location, did you know these people?
No, that's... No, that was part of my, I guess my what you call fantasy. These people were selected.
All right, so you... You were engaged in some kind of fantasy during this period of time?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, when you use the term fantasy, is this something you were doing for your personal pleasure?
Sexual fantasy, sir.
I see.
Welcome back to Crime and Dine, the podcast where we explore the world of true crime, history, food, and mystery. For more than 30 years, the case of the BTK killer was one of the biggest unsolved mysteries in the history of the U.S. The killer took the lives of 10 people in and around Wichita, Kansas, between 1974 and 1991, whilst taunting the police at every turn that he could. BTK felt so invincible, so unstoppable, that he frequently sent packages and letters to media and authorities, demanding recognition for his crimes and hiding clues of his identity within cryptic puzzles. Yet nobody was able to figure out who was the person behind the self-coined nickname and strange cereal box clues. Eventually, as time passed, many thought that the BTK simply got away. And he almost did. My guest this week is the formidable Brittany LeClaire, who is a forensic astrologer from Canada. Brittany did an amazing deep dive into Dennis Rader's natal chart and looked at some pretty interesting things that were happening during some of the most significant moments of this case. The thing that I love most about this podcast is talking to interesting people who've got new takes on criminal cases. So if you're into astrology or you're astro curious, I think you're going to enjoy this one. Now, I know you're probably thinking BTK, cereal, zodiac, like what does this all have in common? The food pairing for this episode is going to be cereal because after all, a cereal box became part of the BTK's undoing. So I'm going to be chowing down on some, and not on mic, I have to add, serial killer cereals. I'm a big fan of Clusterfox and Buster Nut. They're both delicious. It is an ideal palate cleanser for what is going to turn out to be a very bitter crime that just left a bad taste in my mouth. So stick with us. Thank you for listening, and let's get into the episode. On the afternoon of January 15th, 1974, two police officers of the Wichita Police Department were dispatched to 803 North Edgemore. Upon arriving, officers Robert Buhler and Jim Lindbergh were met by 15-year-old Charlie Otero, accompanied by his 14-year-old brother Danny and 13-year-old Carmen. The distraught teenagers told the officers that they had found their father and mother tied up and unresponsive inside the family home. After instructing the children to stay inside, the officers entered the white corner bungalow, walking through a neat and orderly living room, but soon noting a brown leather purse on the floor, its contents scattered across the dining area. Officers kept moving, slowly getting closer to the southwest bedroom, which stood halfway open. And behind the door, they discovered the parents of the three teenagers. 38-year-old Joseph Otero lay face down on the floor, his hands bound behind him and his ankles tied with a white cord. His wife, 34-year-old Julie, lay on the bed, similarly bound, but she had also been gagged. Officer Buhler was unable to find a pulse from either victim. It was clearly too late to do anything to help. The children had already tried without success as they'd returned home from school earlier and made the gruesome discovery. At this point, Lieutenant Jack Watkins was alerted to the scene. As he arrived around 4 p.m, Watkins found the body of 9-year-old Joseph Jr. in another upstairs bedroom. Like his parents, the little boy had his hands and his ankles tied, but he also had a pillowcase over his head with two plastic bags and a t-shirt. Finally, the shocking discovery was made downstairs in the basement, where 11-year-old Josephine was hanging by a rope that had been tied to a sewer pipe. She had been gagged, her underwear was around her ankles, and a semen stain was found on her leg. It was later determined that each of the four Otero family members had died due to asphyxiation or strangulation. Somebody had broken into their house in the middle of the day after first severing the telephone line and making sure that nobody could call for help. Then one by one, the killer had been able to slay four people, two adults and two children. The police were stunned. What kind of individual was capable of putting together and carrying out such a plan? 9 months after the Otero family murders, it became evident that whoever the killer was, he was very proud of his work and wanted to have credit for what he'd done. In October 74, an anonymous caller directed the newspaper worker Don Grange to a mechanical engineering textbook in the Wichita Public Library. Inside the book, Don discovered a letter which read as follows. Quote, "I write this letter to you for the sake of the taxpayer as well as your time. Those three dudes you have in custody are just talking to get publicity for the Otero murders. They know nothing at all. I did it by myself and with no one's help. There has been no talk either. Let's put this straight. I'm sorry this happened to society. They are the ones who suffer the most. It's hard to control myself. You probably call me psychotic with sexual perversion hang-up. When this monster enters my brain, I will never know. But it here to stay. How does one cure himself? If you ask for help, that you have killed four people, they will laugh or hit the panic button and call the cops. I can't stop it, so the monster goes on and hurt me as well as society. Society can be thankful that there are ways for people like me to relieve myself at time by daydreams of some victims being torture and being mine. It's a big, complicated game, my friend, of the monster play, putting victims number down. Follow them. Checking up on them, waiting in the dark, waiting, waiting. The pressure is great, and sometimes he run the game to his liking. Maybe you can stop him. I can't. He has already chosen his next victim or victims. I don't know who they are yet. The next day, after I read the paper, I will know, but it's too late. Good luck hunting. Yours truly guiltily. The letter, which was full of misspellings, was unsigned, but the killer gave himself a macabre name in the postscript. Quote, P.S. Since sex criminals do not change their MO or by nature cannot do so, I will not change mine. The code word for me will be bind them, torture them, kill them. BTK. You see he at it again. They will be on the next victim. There was no doubt of the authenticity of the letter, as it contained details that only the person responsible for the murders could have known. BTK clearly enjoyed the fact that the police were not even close to catching him, and the letter was his way of taunting the authorities. BTK was letting them know he was the one leading in this cat and mouse game. When the killer claimed credit for the murders of the Otero family in his letter, BTK didn't mention another victim he had taken just 3 months after the first attack. On April 4th, BTK had broken into the home of 21-year-old Catherine Bright, where he attacked the young woman and her brother Kevin as they returned to the apartment around 2 p.m. Kevin, who was shot twice in the head, miraculously survived, but Catherine was not so lucky. While her brother had been able to get help after the intruder had run away, Catherine died in the hospital 5 hours later due to 3 stab wounds in her abdomen. Police noted that Catherine had been partially undressed and she had ligature marks around her neck. Despite the living witness, Catherine's killer was not identified. Then all of a sudden, just as he'd appeared, the BTK disappeared. For the next 3 years, there were no new victims, but there was also no progress in the case. Nobody was coming after him, and so when he felt the time was right, the killer was able to return. On March 17, 1977, Wichita police discovered the body of 26-year-old Shirley Vian inside her home. She was partially undressed, hands and feet bound and a plastic bag draped over her head, with a cord wrapped tightly around her neck. Unmistakable BTK MO. 9 months later, on December the 8th, a man who didn't identify himself called 911 saying, quote, yes, you will find a homicide at 843 South Pershing. Nancy Fox, that is correct. End quote. Officers rushed to the address where they discovered 25-year-old Nancy Jo Fox dead in her bedroom, a nylon stocking twisted around her neck. It was hard to believe the arrogance of the killer. BTK was so sure of the police's inability to catch him and so hungry for attention that he had reported Nancy slaying himself. On top of that, in 78, BTK wrote another letter, this time to Wichita's KAKE news station, in which he claimed responsibility not only for the Otero family murders, but also for Catherine Bright, Shirley Vian, and Nancy Fox. In the letter, BTK also expressed his dissatisfaction with the low level of media coverage and the fact that newspapers hadn't published a poem he had written about one of his victims, which begins with, quote, Shirley Locks, wilt thou be mine? End quote. Apparently angered, BTK had asked, quote, how many do I have to kill before I get a name in the paper or some national attention? End quote. Yet as much as the BTK wanted recognition and loved playing his games with the authorities, his killings suddenly stopped again. It was like BTK had vanished from the face of the earth. But still, people in Wichita continued to live in fear, unsure whether the killer would strike again.
Forensic astrology is generally the astrology of crimes, or you could be, some people like looking at murderers' charts in particular. I tend to look at charts created using the time and place of a murder. Or, for instance, when someone goes missing and theoretically, when you look at that, you should be able to kind of make some predictions and see a few things. It's a bit of a misnomer because obviously, like, forensic implies that the data is going to be used in court, which obviously it's not. So, you know, it can be called crime astrology, criminal astrology, forensic astrology. But yeah, it's generally looking at those kind of dark topics using astrological techniques. I mean, all of astrology kind of functions on the basic premise that anything created, you know, in a certain time period and in a certain place is to an extent going to bear the flavor of that time and place. And of course, there's different techniques. So we all have a natal chart, which is based on our time of birth. Other astrologers do what's called like mundane astrology, which is basically like they'll use birth charts or of countries. So, you know, like the US, when they signed the Declaration of Independence or whatever, that would be the chart they would use for the country.
Okay.
And I mean, astrology goes way back to the Greeks and Romans and like sympathetic magic, you know, where the idea that like Apollo, the god of the sun, is associated with sunflowers and, you know what I mean? Things like that, which is kind of very pagan and witchy and Wiccan in a way. So using those associations, you can kind of make, you can be vague, but you can also be oddly specific. And mm-hmm. there are like, we will be talking about BTK and there are some, like you will see oddly kind of specific things that pop out in his charts. Let me talk of him a bit more. But what I do is, yeah, so I'm just drawing this chart. If a murder happens at this time, we look at the chart. The way to read it is a little bit different than modern astrology. Like when we look at modern astrology, we kind of like think about the planets as like psychological impulses. You know, they're like the moon is like your emotions. Mercury is how you communicate. But again, we can make that a lot more concrete, you know. The moon can be women, it can be breasts, it can be the womb, you know, and so on and so on. So it's a lot about putting different symbologies together, using what you know. You know, I'm not going to say, like, I'm a psychic. There might be some intuition in terms of, like, what you pick up on, but a lot of these are just very concrete symbols, you know, that once you learn, we're just putting them together in different ways.
I'm fascinated by that. I'm so beyond fascinated with this. So like, what age were you when you first started kind of getting drawn to this?
I mean, I always knew like I was a Pisces and stuff. Like my mom was a little bit witchy and had tarot cards and, you know, believed in ghosts and paranormal. But I feel like it wasn't probably until like my 20s. And then I started getting more deeper into my own chart and looking at these other placements and, you know, what does this mean? And I came across these astrologers who were doing forensic astrology, but using the event charts, you know, of the murders and when people went missing. And it was magical to me. You know what I mean? It was just, especially those cases sometimes, like people get, when you're a true crime fan, you know, you get really passionate about a case and you want to know all the details and everything you can about it. So in a way, it was almost like giving me a deeper understanding than I could get from just, you know, the bare bone facts. A lot of the time it's like a why, like what makes a person do these things? And I feel like astrology can be really enlightening in those kind of ways.
I think the why is a driver for a lot of people who are interested in true crime, because for me, it's always like, I'm just trying to understand it. I'm just trying to peer over into the abyss for a little bit. And because it feels so chaotic that kind of looking for something to anchor yourself to or looking for some form of order in that chaos, whatever that order might be. You talked a little bit about how you found other astrologers who were looking at the sort of charts of serial killers. And I wonder if this is too much of a basic bitch question, just by all means tell me, but are there patterns? Like, are there like, you know, are Leos more likely to be serial killers? Is it those pesky Capricorns? Like, are there patterns like that?
Well, a lot of people seem this thing, and it goes around the internet, not to say like all serial killers are like mutable signs, but there does seem to be like a preponderance of mutable signs. So that would be Sagittarius, Gemini, Pisces, and Virgo. And, you know, I read an interesting theory that mutable signs, it's like we go with the flow, but it's like we can repeat, you know what I mean? So that could be two for serial killers. Like, is that different than, let's say, if someone murders one person, you know what I mean? And at the end of the day, I think there are signs, but it's nothing concrete. Like, I don't think you could ever look at someone's chart and be like, oh, they're definitely going to be a serial killer, you know? But, like, I could potentially look at someone's chart and be like, oh, they might struggle with narcissism or right. a lack of empathy, or, you know, they might have a short fuse. And again, too, it's like they're predispositions, you know? It's you could be predisposed to being an addict, you know, if addiction runs in your family. Does that 100% mean you're going to be an addict? Like, no, at the end of the day, we still have free will. But you can, I think, get a glimpse at some people's natural instincts or reactions. And I think most of us, as we grow, we tend to learn ourselves better.
Right. I always have that thing, which is like, if you're asking yourself if you're a narcissist, you're probably not a narcissist. If you're asking yourself if you're going to become a serial killer, you probably won't become a serial killer, because you have enough self-awareness maybe at that point to check in with yourself and at least be able to correct course a little bit.
Definitely.
So onto the BTK of it all then. I mean, I find him really fascinating. And actually, there was a period in my life where I fell down the BTK rabbit hole. And it really stuck to me. Like, that story stuck to me in a way that, like, sometimes stories do. And I never really fully know why everybody has their cases that haunt them a little bit. And for me, he's one of them. And there's something about it that's so deeply unsettling. In 1984, a task force devoted to BTK's crimes, nicknamed the Ghostbusters, was established. Not long after, the killer returned. On April 27th, 1985, 53-year-old Maureen Hedge was taken from her home and found dead by strangulation 8 days later. However, her death was not immediately connected to BTK, and neither was the death of 28-year-old Vicky Wegerle, who was found strangled in September of 1986. In Vicky's case, her husband became the primary suspect, while the real killer was on his way to take his last victim. 62-year-old Dolores E. Davis was found on February 1, 1991. She had been taken from her home, strangled, and dumped by a bridge. The coroners found that Dolores had been killed almost 2 weeks prior. By the time her body was discovered, BTK had dropped off the map. For the next decade, it was total radio silence. No new victims, no new letters. It seemed like maybe, just maybe, BTK had retired. But of course, he was far too smug to lay low for the rest of his life. And so, when the 30th anniversary of the Otero family murders came in January 2004, the Wichita Eagle printed an article recalling the terror BTK wielded in the 70s. And the killer responded. The newspaper received an envelope from Bill Thomas Kilman containing a copy of Vicky Wegerle's missing driver's license. While her murder had not been thought to be connected to BTK, the contents of the envelope, which included photos of her body, BTK's distinctive signature and chilling message, made it very clear who her real killer was. On May 5th, BTK continued teasing the media and police by sending them a phony ID, chapter titles for his own biography, and a find the word letter grid, spelling out clues like prowl and fantasies. However, it wasn't realized at the time that the puzzle also included a string of numbers, 6220, referring to the killer's house numbers. In addition, tightly grouped around those numbers were five letters that spelled out the BTK's surname, R-A-D-E-R. So whilst nobody picked up his clue straight away, it seemed like BTK was working his way through the process of telling the world who he was and how he did what he did. Or maybe he just felt so superior, he thought that nobody could figure out his codes anyway. Nonetheless, BTK kept sending letters to the police and leaving packages at the Wichita Library. He wanted authorities to know that he was the one in charge, and he decided how the case progressed. In December 2004, a man walking through Wichita's Murdoch Park stumbled on a bag containing Nancy Fox's driver's license and a Barbie doll dressed up like BTK victims, with a hood over its head and arms tied behind its back. At this point, the police were afraid he might kill again. However, soon enough, the assumed mastermind killer would make a silly mistake that would bring to an end his reign of terror. In January 2005, KAKE-TV in Wichita reported that they had received a postcard from the BTK killer, which directed them to a package he had left for them to find. This kind of message was not one of its kind. BTK had been sending postcards and hiding packages like he was playing a neighborhood treasure hunt, but this time there was something different.
What's your sort of knowledge and experience of this case?
So prior to us talking, you know, this was not a case, like I had a novel about him on my bookshelf, but it was never a case that I like really looked deep into. I feel I have a decent grasp on everything. Like this won't be one of the ones that I'm know every detail about, but for me, I think I was more focused on getting into his head while researching this. So I was focusing a lot on his biography. I tried to find, you know, some childhood stuff. And I was looking a lot at the timing. So in astrology, it's basically real life horoscopes, but they're much more intense than just, you know, like Pisces, this is going to happen. But it's when you compare someone's natal chart to the planets in the sky, you know, that could be now, but you can pick a date, whatever date. So I was looking at the dates of the murders to kind of figure out what he was experiencing. You know, is there a trigger here that explains why did this happen now? You know, so.
Totally. Yeah. And I think this is a really interesting one for you to be looking at in particular, given the sort of nature of the kind of work you do, because of the break in between the two phases of his murders. I mean, he had a bit of a long cooling off period, really. And I think that's really telling. And then there are sort of like very grounded reasons for that. It could be that he was having children at the time and, you know, he couldn't continue his extracurricular activities, but it's always like he started again. So why this time? Why at this time did he start again? What was going on in, you know, January 74 versus, you know, January 1991? Both very interesting that it's sort of the crimes happened in that span.
Yep. Well, I guess first thing would be to look at his chart, like when he was, you know, when he was born. And this is a chart, it kind of, you know, shows who you are as a person all the time. When you add in things that are going on, right, we can have external stressors, but this is mostly about him as a person and things that happen in his life. So, I mean, first things first, we were speaking of mutable signs. He is a mutable sun. He's a sun in Pisces. So Pisces is often, you know, it's dreamy, it's spiritual, can be associated with like religion, the subconscious and dreams. And I mean, he was heavily involved in church and religion through a lot of his life, it seemed. His fantasies, again, Pisces is very dreamy. So we have these fantasies, strong fantasies, shaping his behavior. And I think of Pisces too, it's a water sign, but of all the water signs, it gives me like the energy of like a gas. Things can be like smoky, foggy, you know, like think of your subconscious. It's kind of that kind of vibe, but it's because of things can be foggy, it can also be associated with deception. I mean, obvious, he was basically living a double life. So lying and stuff would have been a big part of that. So we have his son, right? His identity in this foggy sign of Pisces that can easily switch. And we also have his natal Mercury. Mercury is about communication, again in Pisces, which can switch, right? So again, we have this deception kind of theme. Now, honestly, like, if I didn't know this was a serial killer, you know, I wouldn't look at this chart and be like, wow, this guy's evil. Like, I think on a certain level, like, he has a lot of water in his chart. So water is usually associated with, like, sensitivity, you know, emotions, intuitive. There's something we can look at astrology, too, that are called houses. And houses kind of denote areas of life. So he has his sun in the ninth house. And that gives an added kind of spiritual, you know, philosophy kind of vibe. Like, this is a nice guy. He has his moon in Capricorn. So the moon is usually associated with emotions and kind of our natural emotional instincts. The moon in Capricorn, it's not a great place. It's not a horrible place. A lot of great people have moon in Capricorn, but it is a heavy, heavy placement almost. I feel like people with this placement, they have like a really big sense of duty, of tradition, you know, they want to achieve to feel emotionally secure. But his moon, you know, it's also close to the descendant, which in astrology is associated with like relationships. So you put someone's like emotional nature into other people, like I'm sure to his family, he was a really, you know, nice guy in a weird freaking way. And I was listening to his confession before this, and I found it odd when he was talking about the murders of the Otero family, and he talks about how he gave them, you know, I rebinded them for comfort, and the husband had a broken rib, so I gave him a pillow. And, you know, it's really fucked up to call someone caring in that situation, but I think you kind of see glimpses of that water, even at his worst. I mean, when we look at Mars, he has Mars. Now, Mars, when it comes to violence, Mars is a planet you're going to want to look at. Mars is like the warrior planet. It's associated with, you know, self-assertion. You know, how do you get what you want? It could be fighting. And it's also related to sex. Mars in the eighth house is the house of you know, sex and death. And, you know, so that can be really concerned with sexual conquest. But he also, his Mars is an Aquarius. And Aquarius can be unconventional. It can be weird, you know. You hear about him as a child, right? He's having these bizarre fantasies, and it kind of started with like these weird fetishes and, you know, cross-dressing and autoerotic asphyxiation. And, you know, so I think that really was a combination of his like dreamy Pisces sun with this like weird Mars in the house of sex. So you can kind of see how those things kind of starting to form together. It's not just one thing, but it's all of them. You start kind of seeing a picture of the person a bit more.
Yeah, totally. And what's particularly interesting for me is that he would obviously sort of bind his victims and torture them, but then he would also take pictures of himself cross-dressing, sort of bound, putting himself in that sort of situation, which felt like very odd behavior to me, because I thought, I don't know, I had kind of always assumed that like that his involvement in that would be really binary, that like he would want to be the dominant force. But in placing himself like physically in the same space as a victim, that always was something that stuck out to me a little bit. Like, what does that mean? why that?
If we go again too, and he has something in his chart, like now that you mentioned that, I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, he has some things. Like, we go back to childhood, too, to kind of, like, try and understand this a little bit better. In his fourth house of home and family and childhood, he has Neptune. Neptune is kind of the same Pisces energy. It's, like, dissipating. It's gaseous. So one of those expressions can be feeling like, you know, you have an absentee parent, whether that's physically or emotionally. And, you know, when I'm reading his biography, they say his parents worked a lot, didn't seem to pay much attention to the kids. He also has Chiron here, and in astrology, Chiron is symbolic of like a really an inner wounding of some sort. And I was reading and it said, in particular, he seemed, you know, even though both parents were kind of absent, he seemed to really resent his mother. And now in astrology, moon means emotions, but like I said, we have these different symbologies. It also means your mother. And his moon is in the seventh house of other people. Like I said, he's really caring. Is Saturn. Now, Saturn for him, we'll be talking about a lot because it seems to be very important in his chart. And Saturn, it's restriction. It can be bondage, literally.
Oh.
It can be knots. And that's in his first house of self. And that first house is also the body, like your own body. So, you know, he has this opposition with women. He had this obsession with like these binded and tortured women, probably because, again, we have this connection between the moon, women, and Saturn, bondage. But his Saturn, too, when you look at the area of life, it's in his, like my body, too. So it's like, I'm not totally surprised that he would be binding his own body in a weird, you know, like.
from what I gather from hearing stories about him, just sort of anecdotal stories as well, is that he was kind of a bit of a, well, we would say Jobsworth in the UK, but someone who is a bit of a stickler and a bit of a, they're a bit of a blocker sometimes, these kinds of people. They sort of will enjoy process and procedure, not because they enjoy process and procedure, but because they enjoy enforcing it more than anything else.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, Saturn could be bondage. It's in his first house of self. So generally, if someone has a planet in their first house, that will be very prominent in their personality. So Saturn, on top of being, yeah, restrictions and, you know, bondage and, you know, pulling things in is what Saturn does. It's also authority. So you put Saturn, right, you know, in the first house, and that's someone who's like, I'm the boss. I am the authority. You know what I mean? And again, mm-hmm. Cap Moon, Saturn rules Cap. So we're kind of getting almost a double dose in different ways of this, but very authoritative, guaranteed. Yes. That would be totally appropriate.
Yeah. The kind of person who would write you up for a minor sort of hall violation in high school or something, or very much enjoy his little bit of power that he'd be able to wield, is always the impression.
Especially against women, because again, we can't forget the moon and the mama issues kind of shaping this together. So the last thing about just his natal chart that like I picked up on that I found was very interesting. He has Uranus in the 12th house. So in astrology, that can be the subconscious. It's also associated with things that are hidden. So I read a book and I was looking up, doing a bit of research here. And one of the descriptions I read, and I think you could see how this would apply to him just reading straight out of the book, but basically is someone being taught to fit in. They seem normal in public, but much more radical in their views and private behavior. Sometimes someone who feels trapped in their circumstances, so they stay there, but rebellion bubbles inside them. I was like, wow, okay. And again, like, even I have this quote, you know, from the wife who was like, you know, he's a good man, a great father. He would never hurt someone. Like, on the outside, he did seem, you know, very normal, but definitely had some, we'll say, unconventional ideas and behaviors bubbling in the surface. And again, like, that's the subconscious. So again, we have kind of fantasies on top of the more, all those Pisces placements. So you can see how we're building up like similar themes in different ways here. Like, this is giving us an idea of, yeah, how this guy naturally kind of functions a bit psychologically.
Totally. I also wonder if like some of the stuff around him being in the military again, I'm thinking, oh, that's the being bound. That's the kind of Saturn. That's the sort of like the restriction, almost like that sort of order and restriction. I'm sure he probably did quite well in that environment, maybe
a
short period of time. I mean, who knows?
As well, like, because again, that's like a double dose. Like, the moon is about emotions, mother, but also how you feel emotionally secure. So I think he probably would have, you know, yeah, done really well, maybe succeeded. Like, I bet he probably felt emotionally happy while doing that. But you have to have a lot of responsibility, a lot of self-discipline. You know, Saturn can be self-discipline on a brighter, you know, side of things. Someone who has, you know, a strong Saturn is not necessarily, you know, always going to play out like this, as we were saying, but one of the more positive associations, yeah, is like responsibility, discipline, like being a dependable freaking person.
yeah, totally. To the empathy of it all as well, because it's interesting that that kind of shows up quite a bit for him. On the kind of flip reverse of that, he worked for a security company, right? And he would go and he would install these alarms, and often people would be talking about and be concerned about the killings that were happening, and he would be in their house installing their alarms, kind of soaking up those emotions, soaking up that fear. And I wonder what he was getting out of that, because he must have been getting a little something. He must have been getting some kind of kick, or must have been feeding something.
You know, that's interesting. If I had to guess, honestly, I would guess it's just Pisces, again, is intuitive, a lack of boundaries. So, you know, they say, like, some Pisces, they need a lot of alone time because they soak up people's energies. And, you know, huh, he's a Pisces sun with this huge ego. I think that fed him, you know what I mean? Like, oh, like, I'm so big, mm-hmm, and scary, and no one knows. Like, I'm never going to get caught. You know, like, again, you have that, right, ego thing kind of playing out there.
So if we go back to sort of January 1974, what kind of interesting insights do we have about this time?
Well, there's three things I noticed were going on that would have been affecting him personally. So when we're looking at, for instance, when people on TikTok are like, Mercury is in retrograde, it's like, that means Mercury in the sky right now is in retrograde. So, you know, to an extent, that will affect everyone. However, let's say Mercury in the sky is at like the exact same spot as Saturn in your chart. Or, you know what I mean? Mercury is probably not the best example for transits because it moves so fast. But if it hits a personal point in your chart, then it's going to be extra strong for you as opposed to other people. So for him, he had Pluto. I mean, Pluto's associated with like Hades and mythology, god of the underworld, death, whatever, transformation, rebirth, going over his IC, which is associated with childhood and home. So again, this is kind of a direct quote from a book, but it will essentially bring a change in your personal life, family, great psychological change, and may encounter psychological effects from your past relating to childhood, early life, relationship, you know, with parents. It says basically like with Pluto, I don't know if you're familiar with tarot, but it's like the idea Pluto, anything with like a bad foundation, it's going to blow it up like a nuclear bomb. And if you resist those changes, it's going to get worse. Things are going to bubble up. I think a lot of this relates back to his mother in some way, the whole women thing, the resenting his mother. So I think that he's already experiencing that on probably a subconscious level. We also have Jupiter in the sky. Now Jupiter expands things. That's going over his Mars, which is aggression, fighting, fucking, you know, in the eighth house of sex and death. So now Jupiter's expanding this like martial energy. And I mean, if you're, again, this is probably a term heard on the witchy TikTok and stuff, but he was going through his first Saturn return. So a Saturn return is when Saturn in the sky comes back to where Saturn was in your chart. It's returning, essentially. And that's a relatively rare aspect in that it happens to everyone at about 29 and a half years, give or take. So he was experiencing the Saturn return. We already talked about how important Saturn was in his chart and is again kind of connected to this bondage of women. So for like, I don't want to say a normal person, that sounds horrible, but like, you know, for your average person, Saturn return is when we mature. You know, it's like when you hit 30 and you're like, wow, those 20-year-olds really are young and stupid. You know, it's like you're hitting that time in your life where you mature. So it can be a time where if you put in the work, you know, you will get added responsibilities and rewards, you know, you'll experience the positive significations of Saturn. If you're avoiding or, you know, haven't done the things that you need to do, you know, you might get a little bit of a kick in the ass. Like Saturn is like, call it like grandpa energy. You know, he's like, get up, put on the boots and go to work. No complaining. Like, you know, so he's experiencing the Saturn return now. It's activating all this like weird, you know, bondage, women, you know, stuff on top of Pluto, kind of bringing up all these old subconscious family issues, and Jupiter expanding this like Mars and wanting to fight and act and do things. Saturn moves slowly. So the idea is like, you'll start to feel it when it gets close. Then when it gets exact to whatever, you know, the point is in your chart, it'll peak and kind of fade out. So they say a year before this transit, things in life generally start to change and people can be dominated by a feeling that it's your last chance to do things you always wanted to do. Like if you don't do it now, you won't get the chance. Now, theoretically, like you're supposed to let go of these elements that aren't serving you. I think he kind of embraced them and jumped right in here. So for him, again, this is an important kind of time, and I'm gonna be honest, he fucked it up. So there's a lot of karma that's coming. So you can kind of see how he got into this murder, into these murders. But I will say, when he got arrested, this is where, again, very interesting. That was his second Saturn return. That was coming back and finishing the cycle.
Wow.
And now it was time to pay the piper. You know, he didn't put in the work. He got arrested. And again, in a literal sense, for him natally, he has Saturn in the first house, restriction of the self, except this time he wasn't the one who chose it. So, like, from the time of his first murder to the second murder, that was almost exactly, like, two. Like, you can see it in the chart. Like, one Saturn cycle. So that's what I mean. Like, for him, Saturn is really important, and Saturn rules the signs of Capricorn and Aquarius. And again, his moon, women, is in Capricorn, and his Mars, which is fighting and fucking, is in Aquarius. So, like, for him, the Saturn is, like, it plays a big part. And I thought it was very interesting, because often in these charts, I see Pluto playing more of a part. But traditional astrology, like, you know, like, the Greeks and stuff, they hadn't discovered all these outer planets yet. So for them, Saturn and Mars were called the malefics. Like, they were the evil planets. And I think for him in particular, it's almost a great case study of, because sometimes we forget, you know, how bad those planets are. A lot of modern astrologers just look at, like, Pluto, Neptune, or these outers. But for him, like, it's, I think Saturn tells a very prominent story of all this occurring. So if we kind of circle back to before the arrest, again, you're like, well, we're like, why did he come out of hiding after all these years and send this letter? So again, we already know he has a huge ego. At this time when he sent the letter, the sun in the sky, the transiting sun, was just entering his 10th house, and that's public status and reputation. Often it's associated with career. So, I mean, if you want to consider serial killing a career, you know, this is a time where I think his ego wanted to illuminate this. And he also had Jupiter. So again, that energy that expands and gives more of an abundance, entering his third house of communication. So he had a little bit of this going on. And then, you know, all the journalist had to say was basically, no one remembers him. And he, you know, triggered. And here we are again. So, and again, when he pled guilty, the exact day, the sun was almost exactly again on his Saturn. Now, the sun moves about, you know, one degree a day, you know, like every day the sun is going to move a little bit. So the fact that this was, like, very close and would have only happened, like, once a year is, again, very interesting. It puts a spot, like, again, this is more of a generalized description for the average person, but the sun on Saturn puts a spotlight on responsibilities and duties. It feels like you need to fulfill obligations to others, and you can feel isolated, alone, and depressed. So, makes sense. He's arrested. Obviously isolated, alone, depressed. I think the real reason, again, why he confessed and just, you know, pled guilty and owned up to everything was, again, that sense of responsibility, duty. He had ended that cycle, and I think almost that Saturn return cycle. And I think in this way, not to say he was trying to do his best to make it work, but I think he felt, yeah, like he had an obligation. And also when he pleads guilty, he has Neptune, again, a dissipating energy over Mars, which can be power and assertion. So, you know, his power was diminishing. There's not much he could do. He's isolated and alone. So it's like, well, you know, I might as well fucking just come clean and throw it out there.
But you know what's interesting is if you've ever seen, I mean, you were saying you watched it before we talked, but when he's talking through his sort of confession, his taped confession, he's very calm and he's very matter of fact about it. And the thing that kind of skeeved me out a little bit is that I feel like in hearing his recounting of the crimes, all of us as the audience, whether you're in the courthouse or if you're watching at home, you're in it somehow. Like he's exacting a certain level of power over you in his telling of it. I always got the impression that maybe that he wasn't getting off on it, but he was certainly getting some kind of he was getting something out of that. Because we've seen with someone like the Golden State Killer, you know, he won't say bloody anything. Like, he won't say anything at all. Like, his act of sort of power and control is to not give any of the victims' families any budge. But in another way, almost by him sort of spilling his guts in this very calm and controlled, emotionless way, I feel like he is exacting his kind of final act of control.
I could, you know, I could see that too. Because again, Saturn in his first house, the authority, kind of, you know, the power a little bit. You have sun shining on that. And I mean, he has a huge ego. Like, let's be honest, like, of course, like,
Right.
And I hate to bring it all back to ego, because that sounds like such almost like a cop-out, but like in this chart in particular, it's like it's so hard to ignore. And again, that ego is in the sectors of communication and broadcasting. So I'm sure, like, yeah, that was a bit, you know, I think in a way it's kind of like getting credit for it, right?
Him feeling that sort of that power slipping away at that point, you know, everything he did was exacting a certain kind of power and dominance over his victims. And if you take that away, the urge doesn't just go away. It has to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes so much sense to me that, like, if what was going on in his life, in his chart, like, everything was speaking to, like, well, you're fucked now, bud. Like, you're about to spend your time in a darkened cell and not getting very much daylight. I think he's now in solitary confinement, so he lives in solitary. So, you know, you won't be able to do these things. You won't have any real way of exacting your power over anyone. Then the last time he's kind of out in public is the time where he does that. This is kind of final act.
It's dark. It's really.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's unsettling. Yeah. You know, I watch a lot of crime. I feel like I'm pretty desensitized, but there is something just in the delivery that just, it kind of makes you sick to your stomach a little bit listening to it.
It's so matter of fact. Like, it's just so matter of fact. It's like he could be reading anything. He could be reading you a citation. He could be writing, you know, reading you some sort of like passage in church. And I think that's what gives me chills. And I think the reason why some of this case really stuck with me was just the absolute dogged nature of him. Like, the idea that once he got a victim kind of in his sights, then it was game over. Like, there was nothing that any of them could have done. And that was it. And it speaks to a real bogeyman, like, really, truly, like, it's the stuff of nightmares, like someone shadowy waiting for you in your home, waiting to just enact the most horrible acts on you and then kill you. It's horror movie stuff.
How did you get into the house?
I came through the back door, cut the phone lines, waited at the back door, had reservations about even going or just walking away, but pretty soon the door opened and I was in.
All right, so the door opened, was it open for you? Or did
I think one of the kids, I think the younger, Joseph, opened the door. He probably let the dog out because the dog was in the house at that time.
All right. When you went into the house, what happened then?
Well, I confronted the family, pulled a pistol, confronted Mr. Otero, and asked him to, you know, that I was there to basically, I was wanted to get the car. I was hungry, food. I was wanted, and asked him to lie down in the living room. And, at that time, I realized that wouldn't be a really good idea. So I finally, the dog was a real problem. So I asked Mr. Otero if he could get the dog out. So he had one of the kids put it out. And then I took him back to the bedroom.
You took who back to the bedroom?
The family, the bedroom, the four members.
All right, what happened then?
At that time, I tied him up.
While still holding him at gunpoint?
Well, in between tying and yes. Yeah.
All right, after you tied them up, what occurred?
Well, they started complaining about being tied up, and I re-loosened the bonds a couple of times, tried to make Mr. Otero as comfortable as I could. Apparently, he had a cracked rib from a car accident, so I had him put a pillow down for his head. Had he put a, I think he Parker or a coat underneath him. They talked to me about you know, giving the car and whatever money. I guess they didn't have very much money. And there I realized that, you know, I was already, I didn't have a mask on or anything. They already could ID me and made a decision to go ahead and put them down, I guess, or strangle them.
Following BTK's instructions, KAKETV found the drop. A post-toasty cereal box left next to a sign on a rural road in Sedgwick County.
This one felt familiar. The contents included a graphic description of BTK's first murders and another doll fashioned in a grisly position with a rope tied around its neck. Just another taunting message. However, this postcard also included a question from BTK. He wanted to know whether another package he had left at the local Home Depot had been found yet. Soon enough, the police learned why the second package had not been reported. A store employee had told his girlfriend that he'd found a cereal box with weird writing on it in the bed of his pickup truck 2 weeks earlier. But as they thought it was some kind of joke, they had just thrown the box away. Luckily, the police were able to recover the package, which included a very important question from the BTK. Could he communicate via a computer floppy disk without being traced? If so, the police were instructed to run a newspaper ad with the message, quote, "Rex, it'll be okay," end quote. And so the police did. BTK clearly thought the authorities were telling the truth, as 2 weeks later a disc arrived in the mail at another TV station, along with several 3x5 index cards, one of which included instructions for communicating with BTK through the newspaper. But when the police took a look at the contents of the floppy disk, they realized they would no longer have to communicate with BTK through the media, but instead face to face. Hidden metadata of a file containing the message, "This is a test," revealed that the disk had been used by a dentist at Christ Lutheran Church and Park City Library. A quick internet search turned up a website for the church and revealed the name of its president. Dennis Rader, a husband and father of two. Now this man seemed like any other family man. Was this really the person who had slaughtered 10 people and had been taunting the police for decades? Yet BTK being a father actually made sense. It explained why he'd stopped killing for long periods at a time. And of course, BTK had been using cereal boxes, probably the ones he had first brought to his children to play silly word games. Serial killer. Serial killer. It seemed like BTK was a dad who had not been able to resist the ultimate dad joke. So how did Dennis Rader, mild-mannered father, become the BTK killer? Dennis Lynn Rader was born on March 9, 1945, in a quiet corner of Kansas to bookkeeper Dorothea May Rader and gas and electricity employee William Elvin Rader. According to Dennis himself, he suffered a head injury around 8 months old when his mother accidentally dropped him. Quote, "I turned blue, but not taken to the hospital. The right side of the head hit hard. That may have scrambled the network." End quote. And whilst many of us have all bumped our heads in one way or another during our childhood, it's potentially true that head injury at an early age is one of the most stereotypical red flags when discussing the recipe for a serial killer. Growing up, Dennis was described as quiet and polite, and he preferred to keep to himself. He seemed not interested in joining his peers at parties and other social events. It's said that he didn't enjoy music and utterly lacked a sense of humour, but was known for being a studious and focused person, not really the brightest student. As he later said, quote, "I was slow and had problems with big words. Still, today I have to use a dictionary a lot for spelling. To me, playtime or fantasy time was more important than homework." End quote. But for Dennis, playtime didn't mean regular children's games. He used his free time fantasizing about control and torture from a very young age. As he entered puberty, Dennis dreamt of tying girls up and having his way with them. He even practiced what he would do if he ever caught one. He would tie his hands and ankles and place a bag on his own head, beginning to sow the seeds of the early BTK MO. Another classic hallmark of serial killer behavior was soon seen in a young Dennis Rader. He was abusing animals, killing cats and dogs by hanging and torturing them. After graduating high school, Dennis enrolled at Kansas Wesleyan College in Salina for 2 semesters before dropping out. He joined the Air Force in 1966 when he was age 21 and did tours in Greece, Korea, and Turkey before eventually reaching the rank of sergeant. It seems that no one saw signs of Dennis's dark side during his service. He was already a master of blending in and was eventually discharged in the summer of 1970, after which he returned to his hometown of Wichita, Kansas. This is where Dennis continued to build an appearance of an average Joe. He began working at a supermarket and married 23-year-old Paula Dietz. The two had met at church, of course, and they eventually moved to Park City and had 2 children, Kerry and Brian. Through the eyes of an outsider, the Raiders looked like a perfect suburban family. And of course, we don't know for sure if Dennis wanted a wife and children because of the normal reasons you do, or maybe it was because having a family helped him to hide in plain sight. The normalcy was a cover for him, and he could blend in. Between 74 and 88, Dennis worked for ADT Security Services. Part of his job included installing security alarms, often because the homeowners in the area lived in fear of the BTK killings. In 1989, Dennis also acted as a field operations supervisor for the US Census Bureau, connecting information door to door. So it's highly possible that Dennis had initially encountered some of his victims whilst on the job. In his free time, Dennis led a Cub Scouts group and eventually became a church council president. Many of those who knew him referred to Dennis as the kind of guy who nobody ever noticed, someone who never really stood out. And for that reason, he was able to live a double life for over 30 years before finally his own arrogance revealed Dennis Rader's true identity. After discovering the name of the BTK from the floppy disk, the police acted fast. They had found the killer's DNA from the crime scenes, and they now compared it to a sample taken from Dennis Rader's daughter Kerry's pap smear. It was a match. On February the 25th, 2005, Dennis Rader was arrested as he drove back home after lunch with his wife. There wasn't a single sign of distress on Dennis's face as the officers took him in. Finally, he was going to be able to sit down and talk freely about his life's work. But down at the station, the one thing Dennis expressed his irritation for was the fact that the police had lied to him about the floppy disk. He really couldn't believe they'd done that. But at the same time, Dennis was behaving like the agents were his best friends. At first, he was trying to continue their cat and mouse game, but soon enough, he couldn't hold it in anymore. So he began to describe his crimes in great detail. In the end, his recorded confession lasted more than 30 hours and filled 17 DVDs. It was concluded that Dennis most likely had at least 2 personality disorders, narcissism and psychopathy, common among serial killers, but there were a few things that separated him from the others. Unlike many other serial killers, Dennis went on a spree that lasted an unusually long time. He killed infrequently and communicated extensively with the police and the media. Altogether, BTK had sent 19 messages, 10 of them in the 11 months before his arrest. He had become hungry for attention, hungry for that superior feeling. And in the end, Dennis lived so high in his fantasy world that he believed that not even police would dare to lie to him. But of course, he'd been wrong. On June the 27th, 2005, Dennis pleaded guilty to 10 counts of first-degree murder. There was no reason to lie anymore. He was proud of what he'd done. And of course, once again, Dennis got to describe how he had selected, stalked, and finally killed each of his victims. Whilst giving the gruesome details of one of the killings, he said, quote, "I'm sorry. I know this is a human being, but I'm a monster." End quote. While giving his statement, there was no emotion that registered on Dennis's face, other than complacency. It was like he was describing completely normal, everyday events. In the end, as the murders had been committed before Kansas reintroduced the death penalty in 1994, the BTK killer received a sentence of 10 consecutive life terms in prison for a minimum of 175 years without the possibility of parole. Today, Dennis Rader is in his 70s and serving his sentence at the El Dorado Correctional Facility.
But yeah, overall, I think those were a lot of the themes I picked up on. And again, Saturn is just so big and in his natal chart and in the transits happening when all of these things happen, you know, he has that connection with the moon, that mutual reception. It rules his moon and Mars. So again, mother, women, aggression, sex, you know, it was activated during his first murder, activated when he was arrested. And I mean, if you put these two planets together, like, a very basic symbolological interpretation is, you know, he had said, oh, this is from his quote as a child. He admitted, you know, to fantasizing about torturing trapped women, trapped Saturn, restriction, women, moon. And, you know, even if we think of BTK, his symbol, like, okay, bind, torture, kill. Significations of Saturn. And again, these are straight out of my like reference book. Bondage. Brutality, suffocation, knots, death. And he had the little boobies on them. Boobies is the moon. Boobies is mother, you know, breastfeeding. Like,
yes.
Yeah, it becomes very clear the energies that were dominating this man's overall life and chart once we go through it all. So.
I'm so eternally grateful that you looked into it, because this was so much more, even more revealing than I thought it was going to be. And I thought it was going to be pretty revealing. So you've kind of blown my mind a little bit. And I'm just eternally grateful for you doing that, because I've been fascinated and it's been a delight. But I'm going to have to ask you some of my favorite, most revealing questions now, so we can so we can wrap up.
Oh,
and
God,
I can let you live your life.
I didn't think about it. Okay, these are going
to be... Don't worry. Well, we're just going to get pure, like, okay. Real reactions. They're going to be like bang on. And it's funny because I almost feel like that's probably the best way of doing it, because if you think about it too much, you'll agonize over it. So my first question is, what would be your last meal if you were on death row?
My last meal. Oh my God. I'll say surf and turf, steak and lobster.
Okay. What kind of beverage we have? What are the sides? What are the beverages?
Okay. Okay. Vanilla. The vanilla slushy kind of thing from Starbucks that tastes really good. That maybe like a double baked potato with like all the fixing and sour cream and cheese and like bacon.
Yum. Yum, yum, yum. Are you gonna have a dessert? As the warden of this prison, I'm gonna
I might as well. I'm gonna die, so like we should, you know, live it up while we can. This is tough. Okay, double chocolate cake. And ice cream. Vanilla ice cream, though, because that's too much chocolate now.
The Bruce Bogstrotter. Bruce Bogstrotter, as I like to call it. Okay, tell me your 5 dream dinner party guests. They can be living or dead.
All right. Tupac. Edgar Allan Poe. Who else do we got here? Richard Tarnas, amazing. He's alive, but amazing astrologer, historian. Love to pick his brain. Cleopatra, she's the most badass woman in the world. And Kurt Cobain, because I love him.
Oh, of course, we've got to have Kurt. I mean, then he could just do a little ditty at the end of the meal as well, so that'd be ideal. If you're cooking for them, what would you cook for them?
Oh, if I'm cooking? Oh, God, who knows?
You're welcome to order in if you want.
Okay. I make this it's a scallop potato roll, but it has like spinach and ricotta and like, oh my God, it's freaking delicious. I mean, I'm good at making fish, so maybe I would make that, but I don't know. I would just make them what I feel like I would impress them to some extent. So, you know, whatever I'm great at cooking at the time, we'll just feed them that and hope for the best.
And I'll grant you that none of them have any dietary requirements in this universe, and all of them are totally up for eating whatever's put in front of them. So,
oh, great. And like, God, we'll take that. I live in Canada, so like, we could have some THC gummies for dessert and just shoot nice. The shit. And, you know, it'd be a really nice evening, I think.
It would be so cool to see Cleopatra and Kurt Cobain just like hanging out
with Tupac.
And just be like, wow. With Tupac.
And Edgar Allan Poe. Very interesting group.
Very diverse, yeah. Okay, and if I could give you the secrets to one unsolved mystery, what would it be?
Kanika Jenkins. Although they say that one's solved. So I'm like, the astrology, honestly, I've done the charts and stuff, and I'm like, okay, maybe she did walk into the freezer by herself, but part of it just doesn't sit right with my soul still, so...
Okay. I will give you the secrets to Kamika Jenkins, and it belongs to you. You can't share it with anyone, but you have it now. It'll be arriving in your inbox in 3 to 5 business days.
Thank you. I've waited so long.
And all it took was one podcast. Brittany, thank you so much. This has been absolutely delightful. I am so fascinated. I could listen to you talk about this stuff for hours. So I'm delighted. So yeah. Thank you. There could have been a very different ending in the case of the BTK killer. He had vanished for over a decade and had been able to stay unidentified for more than 30 years. Dennis could have just lived his life with his family, no more killings, no more communication with the authorities, and he may have never been found. But Dennis's ego couldn't let him do that. After seeing an article written in the Wichita Eagle about his work, Dennis felt the same rush that he had felt all those years ago. And so BTK announced his return, waking up the sleeping terror, but only for a moment. Who would have guessed that one of America's most notorious serial killers would get caught not just because of his arrogance, but with the help of a cereal box and a floppy disk? That is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and for Brittany for just being such an amazing guest and offering a very unique perspective on what has been a very well-covered crime. I was always fascinated by the awful pun and dad joke of the cereal box in this case. It's the food element for me, always the thing that I'm kind of voraciously trying to consume. So I hope you enjoyed it. You can find all kinds of really good stuff in the description. You can find all of the sources for this episode. Go and have a little read and a deep dive. You can also, if you're interested in Crime and Dine coffee, they are delicious blends. You can head over to crimeanddine.store to shop Wake the Dead and Magical Morning Coffee, and also fun totes, apparel, t-shirts, all that good stuff. This episode was written and produced by me, Tiffany Scott Maddox, and edited by G. Marie Gibson. You can find Crime and Dine on all the socials. Go to Crime and Dine Stories on Instagram, or Crime and Dine on TikTok, and Crime and Dine on Twitter. We'll see you next time.